Land Board is to take up a hot-button issue that some fear could set a bad precedent for public lands across the state. It has to do with Public Beach, long used by the hotel for resort activities. Critics say the state hasn't been adequately compensated. The Sierra Club, Hawaii's Thousand Friends, the Surfrider Foundation, and a handful of Kahala and Diamond Head residents have written the Land Board and the staff of DLNR about their concerns about public access. We reach out to the Sierra Club and the Kahala Hotel to talk about the issue. Resort GM Gerald Glennon told HPR for the last year he's attended every neighborhood board meeting to keep residents apprised of the hotel's plans and to work through public access issues with the land division of DLNR.
Well, we're pretty transparent, I think, about it. And, working closely with the staff at DLNR to get some clarification principally on what our current revocable permit and the one which we feel will be renewed allows under the auspices of maintenance and recreation. That's kind of where we are, but there have been a lot of conversations about that, and really what we want to do is just to be able to clarify, you know, what the permit actually allows us to do.
So what does the permit cover?
The permit essentially allows us, it's a revocable permit, it's renewed at this time of year for the period usually January 1st to December the 31st, and that permit allows us access to the beach and what we refer to as a state parcel, which is just Mauka of the beach. It's about a 20 or so foot stretch of grass, and I think you might be familiar with that parcel, Catherine. It gives us access for recreation and for maintenance, so the cleanliness and cleaning of the beach, maintaining all of the landscaping, as well as being able to provide recreational services for not only our hotel guests, but any non-hotel guests who might come into the area.
And I understand that some of these groups want a higher compensation for the state.
And I think that's a reasonable request and something that's on the table with the staff at DLNR. We've been paying a fee every month for as long as I can remember, and that was agreed upon with the Department of Land and Natural Resources. However, times change, and if it's necessary that a reappraisal of the value of our access needs to happen, we're totally on board with that.
And there were some non-conforming uses, if I recall, that were then, I guess, given the okay. I know, I think there's a raft out there.
Yeah, there is a float, and that's been there since, for decades, actually. You remember that, Catherine, when the hotel was first built, Conrad Hilton and Charlie Peach Jr. Were the ones who developed the property. That was pretty much a mud flat and rocks, and they were given permit to create that beach. They dredged the swimming lagoon, which was approved at the time. They created the beach, and the fill from the dredge was thrown up and became that grassy parcel you see on the top. So the float, there were actually two of them at one time, has been there since that beach was created. And I'm not an expert, but I would imagine that it's long grandfathered as a recreational use of that area.
And you have expanded some of the recreational uses there on the beach. I think you brought in a canoe.
Actually, that is not the hotels. That is a vendor who moors there. I think he's allowed to be at anchor for 72 hours at a time. It's an access or mooring area, and the canoe comes and goes. But that is just as any other vendor we use for guests, whether it's skydiving or surfing or whatever. It's a company called Holokino. Austin Kino is the proprietor of that, and his permitting and everything is all on his shoulders. He comes and goes, and we do make that activity among many, many others that we offer to hotel guests available, but it's not part of the hotel. There was a time when there were chairs on the beach, and that has totally been removed. There was a time that we did conduct weddings and so forth, and we received notice on that, and it took us a while to get organized, but since August of 2017, we've discontinued promoting and selling of any weddings or corporate events on the Cocoa Head Lawn or the Diamond Head Lawn. And if you see it today, they're empty. There was a gazebo on the Diamond Head Lawn, which was there for decades, and it is now gone. And we created a spot on our leasehold to accommodate that function. So if you were to come here early in the morning, you would see a clean, empty beach, and the Diamond Head entry to the center of the property is essentially empty. We also introduced a grass pathway and put signage on the Diamond Head entry that basically says, welcome public access. We've also put additional signage on the street at the stop sign at the base of our drive, which points an arrow to the public access for the beach, as well as shoreline access postings on our building. So we're definitely open to the public. It's public land. However, on the Cocoa Head side, there are a few things that we consider recreational, such as some cabana tents and chairs, a beach shower, which was put in, and that's for the use of non-hotel guests as well as hotel guests. And then we have some portable seating in an area we call Seaside Grill, and that is a public restaurant and public thoroughfare, but there do happen to be some chairs and tables there, and we do serve food and beverages to both guests and non-guests. And what we're trying to understand is we consider all of that to be recreation, which is allowed by our permit, but the group that is basically taking a position against our current use, they and the hotel want to clarify with the help of DLNR and BLNR, what exactly does recreation mean? And that's what our conversations and what our hearings will address. Our owners have actually had the hotel for, it'll be about 4 years this fall. And in that time, I have to tell you, we've done more to reduce the footprint and any activity on both the beach and the state parcel than any previous owner has. And I think that's evidenced by anyone who would want to come and take a walk and see what we are actually doing there.
That was Gerald Glennon, Kahala Resort's general manager. We also talked with David Kimo Frankel, who is helping the Sierra Club in its fight to preserve public access.
Well, this is prime beachfront property that the public has demonstrated its interest in using, but it's been commercialized and is being exclusively used in good portions by the hotel. One issue is the flagrant and deliberate violation of the law, where they have constructed things on public land without authorization, where they're having commercial uses, including a restaurant on public property without authorization. So that's one issue. A second issue is it appropriate to have commercial use of prime beachfront property that the public could use? A third issue is, if commercial use is appropriate, how should it be valued? Should the state be getting its money's worth, which it's not? And the final issue is, what conditions are going to be imposed on the use of this land? Some of the activities that have been going on are not long time. They are with this current owner. Secondly, it's irrelevant what was done in the past. Thirdly, there's no such thing as grandfathering. This is public land. And the only authorization the hotel uses is what's allowed in the revocable permit. And the permit only allows recreational and maintenance purposes. Those are the only uses. And the DLNR has explained in the past that commercial uses are not allowed. Despite this, the hotel has gone ahead and engaged in extensive commercial activities of public land. The hotel has blocked plans to allow public access to go all the way from the Diamond Head side to the Cocoa Head side of the property. In fact, there's this restaurant that occupies this land, a chunk of this land, making it difficult for the public to access across when the tide is very high, such as on the King Tide days. So it doesn't matter how many meetings he has. The deal is he has to comply with the law, and the hotel has not been.
And so what are you asking the state?
Well, we're asking them to consider these four issues. One, fine the hotel for its violations. Two, decide what's more important, the public or a multinational corporation's desires. The hotel has plenty of land on its property that it has a lease on from Kamehameha Schools to get engaged in all the commercial activities it wants. It doesn't need to use public land to do that. But if you are going to let the hotel use public land for commercial purposes, charge them what a commercial operator is supposed to be charged. You know, this radio station uses a radio tower in the conservation district for which the tower owner pays the state about $9,600 a month. The Kahala, for a small fraction of land, The Kala Hotel uses 10 times more land, about almost an acre, and pays only $1,400 a month. In other words, it's paying about 7 to 8 times less than a radio tower in the conservation district. It makes no sense. A number of us have taken the position that this prime beachfront land should be used by the public and only for the public for general recreational uses. But if the DLNR disagrees and they're going to commercialize it, then the state should be getting its money's worth. It has, the Board of Land and Natural Resources has a fiduciary duty. It's managing state assets, and therefore it should be like being a good steward. And if it's going to let private interests dominate public property, then it needs to increase the rent that's being charged.
Now, I know the whole idea of presetting beach chairs and umbrellas is a hot-button issue, particularly in Waikiki, where there's not a lot of land, and we see a lot of hotels doing that.
Sure. So there's two parcels of land here to be considered. One is what we all consider the beach, the sandy area, and the state has made it very clear they're not the hotel is not supposed to be presetting beach chairs there. The hotel has violated that requirement a number of times, but more recently they have been complying with that requirement. However, on the land that's just mauka of the beach, that is state-owned land, and chairs are preset there. And that is a problem because, first of all, because those are rented out at high rates, so they're not available to the general public. So they're really for the exclusive use of the hotel, and the state is not getting its portion of that money.
And you're talking about the cabanas?
The cabanas, sure. Yes, that's part of it.
And I know initially when the hotel raised the question of, okay, what if we set these chairs out, preset them, but then the public gets to use them too?
So they're not letting the general public use the cabanas, only the less quality chairs. That's what the public gets. So, yeah, that's... And then the other chairs that are, one could say, preset are the restaurant chairs. There's an entire restaurant on public land on this property for which the public, at least as of a month and a half ago, was excluded. There's a sign saying it's for the exclusive use of hotel guests, and that's on public land.
This stretch of public land has been in use by the hotel property owner, whoever that happens to be, for some length of time.
So a number of the uses have been authorized by revocable permits, which are only good for a month at a time. The hotel has no vested right to use public land. Public land cannot be absconded with by a private entity. It's irrelevant what the hotel owners did in the past, quite frankly. And we believe this hotel owner has been far more aggressive about attempting to privatize and commercialize that public space. But it doesn't really matter what previous owners did. The law is clear. They are not allowed to use this property for commercial purposes.
But the state has allowed it. So what do you say to the state?
The state has been a bad trustee of public resources, and it needs to do a better job.
Where else have we seen this on the neighbor islands?
Hotels dominate public beaches. We know that. Isaac Hall on Maui has brought a couple cases where preset beach chairs were a problem. The hotels will take and take and take, and they will stop momentarily if they're slapped in the wrist, but they'll be back and they'll be back because it's in their interests.
Okay, and you mentioned that the hotel only stopped doing the gazebo weddings this summer after you folks sent a letter.
We sent a letter. We included a photograph of the gazebo, wedding gazebo on public land. Only after that letter was sent did they move the gazebo back off of public land and onto the hotel's property. So the staff is recommending that all violations be forgiven, that commercialization of the area be continued and accelerated, and that the hotel pay a minimum amount of rent. The fact is the hotel's permit has expired. They have no authority to use the land this way. They're seeking permission, which the board is free to deny, and it should deny.
That was Dave Frankel, who is working with the Sierra Club. He was talking about the renewal of a permit for the hotel for the use of the Kahala Beach land that expired in July. DLNR staff is recommending the permit be renewed and that the fees be hiked by 1%. The groups think that's unacceptable. Now, the board was to take up the issue this Friday, but because of the pending hurricane, that meeting will be rescheduled at a later date. Next in the program, we'll hear about concerns over Hawaii's tax credits for the TV and film industry. So in today's quiz, we're looking at a cinema classic that was filmed here in Hawaii. Now, that alone doesn't set this film much apart. There have been over 100 movies, at least partially shot in Hawaii, since the early days of the film industry. The islands have also served as the setting for more than 50 different films. However, there is one prominent movie that has earned a unique distinction in Hawaii filmmaking. This production was filming on Kauai when the devastating Hurricane Iniki made landfall in 1992. The majority of cast and crew hunkered down and rode out the storm, but a few intrepid camera operators made a point to capture shots of the passing storm. Their reason? Well, several scenes of the film were set during a major hurricane, and those scenes incorporating the real-life footage of Hurricane Iniki made the final cut and have been seen by the millions who watched this mega hit. Now, do you know which film this was? If you do, call 941-3689 or 877-941-3689 if you know the answer. The first one to get it right gets a reusable tote bag that tells people that you got it right.
Aloha, I'm Linda Santos, the zoo director from the Honolulu Zoo. If you want to listen back to a show, visit the conversation page at hawaiipublicradio.org.
Last year was a big one for the film industry here in the islands, generating more than $300 million into the economy, according to the state's own business figures. But the legislature, over concern about giving away more than $50 million in tax credits, added additional conditions about cultural sensitivity and transparency, and even capped the motion picture, digital media, and film tax credit. Now, industry officials are nervous about whether that will drive away business, particularly on the neighbor islands, which are eager to boost their economies. We talk with Justin Finestone, the head of the film office on the Big Island, about what lies ahead.
The cap that takes effect on January 1st would cap the film credit to $35 million a year. And with two television series being produced on Oahu now, Hawaii Five-O and the new Magnum PI, conceivably, based on past incentives that Hawaii Five-O has received, that would take up the $35 million, so there'd be no other money left for any other production. Now, there are some other bigger films being produced on Oahu that will also qualify for the cap, so they would roll over to the next year. So they would have to wait a year for another $35 million to be created to get their tax credit. And I think bigger productions like the Kong Skull Islands, the Jumanjis, they can wait an extra year for their rebate. But smaller productions that typically come to the neighbor islands cannot. And the threshold to qualify for a rebate is only a $200,000 budget. So those are much smaller productions, and they really rely on that tax rebate to get their project made. And so they're not going to be able to wait a year because they're on such a tight shoestring budget anyway. And so our fear is that those smaller productions and projects that typically we see a lot of on the neighbor islands aren't going to be able to afford to have their project go forward.
So what's your hope that come January when this kicks in, that there might be some way to be able to sway lawmakers to kind of relax this credit?
Yeah, I know the industry has worked really hard with lawmakers trying to educate them on how much money the industry does bring to the state and why that film tax credit keeps things humming along and keeps people employed. So, you know, the strategy would be to hopefully get them to, if not eliminate the cap, then raise it to something more in the range of $50 million. We tried that this last session and were unsuccessful. But I think raising it to something like at least $50 million would definitely give some breathing room to hopefully still be able to help those smaller productions that a lot of people rely on as well.
If I recall, transparency was one of the things that some lawmakers were concerned about.
Yeah, there was an audit done on the state film office and how they do the tax credit, and there were some definite critical points brought up, and I know the state film office said, yep, we can do better, and they have been doing better and making sure things were running how they should be. But I think some of the concern was the amount of money being paid out. I think last year was $55 million went out in tax credits. But at the same time, production spent $320 million in this state. So I think we see far more economic benefit from the film and television industry than we pay them in tax credits. So I think it's just it takes a long time to get that message across, and I think us in the industry can do a better job of helping the legislature understand what a critical part of the state's economy film and television production is. And it also helps our number one industry, the tourism industry, as well.
Can you talk about how the Big Island fared, you know, last year?
Yeah, so last year we had several reality TV projects. We had a lot of travel stuff. We had a lot of food television came here. But we did about, according to our permit stats, we did about $10 million in production in last fiscal year, 17-18, on the Big Island. And that's just permit data from my county office. So if a production came to the island and only shot on private property and didn't need a permit from me, I'm not sure what they spent. So we definitely did more than $10 million, and that's a good year for us.
So as far as the credits?
The tax credit, so I'm not sure how many would have qualified for the tax credit because the state handles that exclusively. The counties aren't involved in the tax incentive. The state film office runs that. So, but I know that, again, if a production had more than a $200,000 budget, then they're eligible to apply for that, and they work with the state film office to get the rebate based on their qualifying expenditures.
Right, so your concern is going forward with a cap as low as it is, in your estimation, that you might not get as much business as you would normally.
No, for example, there's a feature film that was just running at theaters in the state, and now it's on the mainland, and it's also available online. It's called Running for Grace. So they shot exclusively here on the Big Island a year and a half or 2 years ago. Had a several million dollar budget, small film, you know, not over a $10 million budget, it's just a few million dollar budget. But they created 175 jobs, mostly on the Big Island, mostly local jobs. And the production supported an estimated 875 more jobs. You know, obviously they're buying hotel rooms, they're renting cars, they're buying supplies. And so I talked to the producers of that film, and they said, absolutely, without the tax credit, that film would not have been made. So if they could not get their tax rebate, if they were coming into production next year, it might not have happened because of this new cap on our rebate.
And so tell us about the facilities that you have on island there.
Yeah, we have a film studio here called Honua Studios. It's the largest independent film studio in the state, and it's they figure they can handle anything, any film or project up to about a $10 million budget. They have a 4,000-square-foot green screen stage. I think it's one of the largest in the state. They have an audio production facility, soundproof booth called The Cube. They've got high-speed fiber. It's the highest-speed fiber in the state. Connects directly to studios all over the world so that somebody doing production or post-production or whatever, here on the Big Island, they can send their footage in real time virtually back to the mainland. So they've been here for, I think, 3 years now. Running for Grace, the film I spoke about, they use that facility extensively. They built sets in there. So it's a great kind of piece of infrastructure that we have here on the Big Island that we're proud of, and hopefully get some more use out of it. It was founded on a partnership between the state and the county and private monies. It's been real good for us, and we hope it sticks around for a long time.
Yeah, so you hope their dance card is filled.
Exactly. And, you know, it's a multi-use. They rent it out for events, and they've had screenings in there. And so they get a lot of use out of the building. I know one of our local companies that produces luaus at the resorts here on the island, they use it for their office space, and they use it for rehearsals. So it does get a lot of use for other things when it's not being used for film production. It's great that the county film offices, along with the state, we all kind of work together to market the island for production. So I know Maui gets a lot of commercials, and Kauai just had a big film, Jungle Cruise, shoot there. But we'll go to events on the mainland, or we'll pool our resources to market the island as a whole, because we know when a production comes to Hawaii, no matter where they're shooting, really the whole state wins. And, you know, a good example for the Big Island was Jumanji. It shot, obviously the majority of it was shot at Kualoa Ranch on Oahu, but they came over to the Big Island and shot their waterfall scenes here, and they were here for about 4 days total. So we know that when we have production on one island, it really does benefit the rest, and we have a great group of film commissioners here in the state that really understand that, and we really work together to do our best to make sure that we're all kind of doing well in this industry. It's worth noting that our film rebate right now is 20% for Oahu, but the neighbor islands, you qualify for a 25% rebate. So you do get an extra 5% by coming to the neighbor islands, so the state is helped us to incentivize the neighbor islands in that way. And so, you know, if it pencils out that a production can find the exact location they want on a neighbor island and that 5% makes a big difference to them, then they'll come. Because it is a little more expensive to do business on the neighbor islands, because oftentimes we don't have the film infrastructure that they have on Oahu, so they'll have to bring in more crew, they'll have to bring in some equipment, and that costs a little extra money. So that's why that extra 5% is there for the neighbor islands. For example, in 2015, the state of Louisiana, they had a film tax credit, and they put a cap on it in 2015. And virtually the entire film and TV industry that was working in Louisiana went to Georgia next door, because Georgia has no cap. And now Georgia is one of the biggest hub for production in the world. So they're really benefiting from that. So, you know, there is some history that limiting those kind of production incentives does harm to the industry. But, you know, again, it's our job to show the legislature that it's a worthy program. It's not costing the state. It's helping the state. And I think that's the message, is it does help the state, and we have to do a better job of illustrating that.
And just yesterday, the Tax Foundation of Hawaii weighed in on the impending cap. You can check out Tom Yamachika's weekly commentary online. Also this week, the film community is expected to turn out for the Made in Hawaii Film Festival. It runs this Saturday, August 25th, screening a full lineup of Hawaii-created content at the historic Palace Theater in downtown Hilo, all part of an effort to help lift Hawaii's creative industry. Learn more at the Conversation's Facebook page.
Support for The Conversation comes from Haleakala Waldorf School on Maui and Honolulu Waldorf School on Oahu, serving Hawaii's families from infancy with parent-child programs through high school, now accepting applications at both schools.
Now time for the reality check with our partners at Honolulu Civil Beat. Suvan Lee has a story about an election challenge in a state house race. Hi, Suvan.
Hi, Catherine. Thanks for having me on.
Yeah, so tell us about this 21-page complaint.
Yeah, it's an election challenge filed by unnamed voters in District 30, which covers Kalihi. It stems from the District 30 State House Democratic primary race, in which longtime incumbent State Rep. Romy Cachola was trying to defend his seat. Of course, he won the Democratic primary over his opponent, who is Sunny Ganadin, by 51 votes, which is the slimmest margin in a state house race we've seen this year. Now, this complaint alleges that Representative Cachola engaged in voter fraud and in intimidation by tapping into voters in the Kali'i area who also happen to be alleged clients of medical care that's offered by his wife's medical clinic. Now, there's a lot to this suit as far as the allegations. Who are these prospective voters who are voting absentee by mail, for instance? license. That really is the premise of the suit. Mr. Cotrola won by a very high percentage of mail-in absentee ballots. About 71% of his total votes, in fact, came from mail-in ballots. That's a little bit, it's a bit higher than the state average, which this year was 62%. So there's a couple questions that's raised by that percentage, according to the complaint. But the correlation that goes back to the voters is, who are these voters and were they coerced into voting by mail through unseeming tactics?
Now, during the primary election result returns, I know they were kind of like neck and neck. So it was really, you know, one of those sort of cliffhanger races.
Right. I don't think anyone's alleging that a disproportionately high number of absentee mail-in ballots would necessarily raise red flags. However, you had to look at the history of the primary races in which Representative Cotrola has been accused of voter intimidation. Speaking of this primary race in particular, this one this year, the race, yes, as you mentioned, was very close. In fact, by midnight, Sonny Gadadin was up 10 votes, 720 to 710, I believe. But by the fifth and final printout, as we know in Hawaii, that's collected around 3 a.m. is when the final results are released. Mr. Cotrola had edged him again by based on the sheer number of last counted absentee mail-in ballots. So where were those ballots coming from? It was a last-minute surge. That, I think, is what was problematic to these unnamed plaintiffs who are filing this lawsuit. Again, the plaintiffs are unidentified voters of District 30 who claim that they were intimidated by the incumbent into voting for him. So we don't really know. It's a little unclear where these mail-in ballots have come from and whether they were collected fairly or not.
Now, do we know why the folks that filed the lawsuit didn't put their names to it?
Well, I believe this is one of the few, if not only, elections complaint in Hawaii in recent memory that features unidentified plaintiffs. Now, I spoke to the attorney, Aaron Wills, yesterday when the complaint was filed, e-filed with the Hawaii Supreme Court, and he said that it's to preserve their, security and confidentiality. Some of them do in fact receive medical care from Remy Cotrola's wife's medical clinic. I know that there was a line in the complaint that talked about possible negative repercussions were their identities known. As you know, Kalihi is a small community. There's a lot of first-generation Filipino immigrants. If their names were out there and they come forth, accusing essentially a longtime state representative of voter intimidation, I think word will spread. Surely it's not ideal to have their names under wraps. But I think they decided to do this very strategically so that they wouldn't be prone to any, let's say, consequences of withheld medical care, for instance. But I encourage anyone who reads the article to go in and read the complaint, which is attached to the story.
All right. Okay. Thanks so much, Suvan. We really appreciate you keeping on top of this. I know you folks were doing stories about this particular race and the campaigning that was done to reach out to the Micronesian community. But we'll be tracking it. Thanks so much.
Sure. Thanks for having me on.
That was reporter Suvan Lee with today's Reality Check. To read the full story, visit civilbeat.org. This hour, the Water Commission is meeting to talk about what to do about water on the island of Kauai. It's been a hot topic issue here on Oahu, as well as on Maui and now on the Garden Isle. That's a story that HPR reporter Ku'uwehi Hirishi is tracking. She joins us here in the studio with What's at Stake.
Yes, aloha, Catherine. That's right. So the Hawaii Commission on Water Resource Management is meeting today to essentially figure out how much water should be returned to a couple of streams that come from Waialeale, the wettest place on earth.
Yes, it's very wet. I've been there.
Yes, and so that meeting is today. And what's really at stake is basically you've got these irrigation ditches that have been in place for more than 100 years, 140 years in Lihue Plantation's case. And that water has been diverted for that long. And so the streams in which they would have normally or traditionally have flowed from mountain to sea have not been in place for that time. So right now the commission is trying to figure out, okay, how much do we need to put back in there because the diversions are still going on.
Right. And the latest one was for a hydroelectric
That's
dam,
right. So this specific request or what's being talked about now is, so Kauai Island Utility Cooperative, KIUC, over on Kauai uses that water some of those water diversions at Waikoko and off of the North Fork of the Wailua River. So a lot of folks know that place called Blue Hole, a popular tubing spot on Kauai. That's where this water is coming from. And they want to continue diverting water from Waialeale to a new proposed hydroelectric plant. So they've got five hydroelectric plants already on Kauai right now. And that it contributes about 7.5% of renewable energy or of energy to Kauai residents. And so this new project, which would produce around 6 megawatts of power, could come online next year if the commission, the Water Commission, decides to continue these diversions at the rate that's being proposed.
Now, here on Oahu and then also on Maui, a lot of the concern about water diversion has been tied to development, is that they fear a lot of that resource then will just go to build homes and for the developers to make money.
That's a very real concern, and that is something that we're seeing across the island state because of that sort of plantation era where, for example, Lihue Plantation, so established in the mid 1800s, they went ahead and built this ditch system to take water from the wettest spot on earth and feed the sugar plantations and their sugar crops. Now, it takes so much water. Everyone knows it's 500 gallons of water to produce 1 pound of sugar. So they were taking enormous amounts of water everywhere across the island chain to feed these sugar plantations. But once the plantation started to fold as early as the 70s through the 1900s, and I think Lihue Plantation closed in 2000, end of 2000. Once that started to happen, the ditches were still in place. Water was still being used, and county systems and developers, in this case, the utility cooperative, they had all been depending on that water diversion. So now it's a matter of, oh, wait, what should we be doing to return some of that water into the stream, but still have it used for things like development or county residents. Over on Maui, that was the big sort of balancing act that the commission had to go through was, okay, Kula and Upper Maui need some of this water. We can't completely take everything out, but we need to restore a good number of this into East Maui, which was the most recent decision by the commission.
Right, and I believe the folks are concerned about what development plans Grow Farms might have.
Grow Farms, yes. So Grow Farms has some of the former Lihue Plantation land, and that's over on the south side of Kauai. They have this initial sort of fact-finding mission that the commission went into earlier this year, and then also last month they went and visited the staff for Quorum went to visit some of these diversions and talk to everyone to figure out exactly how much water is being diverted, because that's sort of the unknown for a lot of these places. When the water code came into place in 1987, it was thought that, okay, this is way too much work for us to go and check every single stream in Hawaii and set a standard. Let's kind of just take everything as is, say this is the minimum amount that you need in the stream for now. And as it comes online, as people sue or as developers or utility co-ops like KIUC want more water or want a permanent amount of water diverted, then the commission will make that decision. So with respect to Grow Farms, they are one, they are also diverting water from this particular stream.
I remember Grow Farms let us up back up into the area to do an inspection of, I think it was Waita Dam, the reservoir up there. And I was just struck at how powerful it was to look at all this water, because I think it's the largest dam on that island. And it was just amazing, you know. And that was a tour following the breach of the dam.
That's right.
Up at Coloco. And so it was just fascinating to be able to see what else was there on the island and how large that one was. But to see all that water in one place,
exactly.
Very powerful.
This irrigation system for Lihue Plantation that was built is, you're talking about like 51 miles of ditches hauling water every day. So returning some of that to the streams is something that the commission is going to just decide on today.
So do you know what the process is? I mean, will the parties have a chance to appeal if they don't like the decision that comes down?
Yes. So they can go into a contested case hearing if anyone is not happy with the final decision. But once the commission decides, and they've been a lot more proactive, we've seen that on in East Maui and also in West Maui earlier this year. But once the commission decision comes down, that's when KIUC would need to either return some of that water or will continue diverting.
Right. So lots of really important issues to track.
Definitely.
And so you'll be filing some updates, some stories tomorrow?
Yes.
Okay. All right. Thanks so very much, Kuvehi. That was HPR reporter Kuvehi Hiraishi outlining some of the issues related to the diversion of water on the island of Kauai. To track her stories, go to hawaiipublicradio.org.
Aloha, I'm Aiden James from Honolulu. You're listening to The Conversation on member-supported Hawaii Public Radio.
Meghna Chakrabarty. Coming up on the next On Point, hours and hours of screen time. How much are digital distractions changing the way kids think and even read? That's coming up on the next On Point from NPR.
This afternoon at 2.
In today's Backyard Quiz, we asked you to give us the name of a film shot on Kauai during Hurricane Iniki. The year was 1992, and Steven Spielberg was coming off directorial hits Hook and Schindler's List. He was at the helm of a new project filming on Kauai when Hurricane Iniki made landfall during production. Now, the Category 4 storm proved devastating to Kauai, destroying many homes, businesses, and famous landmarks. Spielberg and his crew were caught completely by surprise, waking up to the dire weather reports on the last day of filming. Now, Iniki destroyed many of the film sets and forced the crew to shelter in their hotel and ride out the storm. Now, despite the carnage outside, the crew managed to capture a few shots of the storm as it passed. These ended up being used in the final cut of Jurassic Park's climactic sequence, which is set during a major hurricane. And congrats to Don Brown of Honolulu. You are our winner. And that's today's quiz. If you have an idea for one, you can send it to talkback@hawaiipublicradio.org. Earlier this year, we reached out across the globe to find Hilo native Kamaka Diaz as he was wrapping up his stint in the Peace Corps. Now, Diaz was able to raise several thousand dollars to buy new computers to help students studying in his town in Madagascar. We reconnected this month to learn he's extended his stay for another year and has moved to the capital city, where he has Wi-Fi and was able to Facebook with us. Now, he says the computers will go to help set up a lab where students will not only be able to learn English, but to learn computer skills in an effort to bridge the digital divide. He was still basking in the grand opening of the lab, which was held earlier this month, and he was getting settled in his new job.
We had enough to buy 11 computers for our English center, and one I donated to my CEGE, which is like the middle school. Another I just donated to the LYCE, which is a high school right before I left, and then another one we gave to a radio station.
Oh, that's
so
great.
It is going into the English center, our computer lab, and that was already set up, and we got all these apps installed, so... Yeah, things are looking really good.
So what was the reaction from all the students?
They're like, way! That's how they celebrate. But yeah, they're really excited. The teachers were more excited because the computer would be going into their office, I guess. But for the kids at the English Center, they're really excited. It was funny because we got it installed and we had the party and we invited a lot of the kids parents so they could see what we've been doing or the kids have been doing, because we were working on a world map outside of the English Center for like a week and a half, and they're helping paint the inside, move the tables in and do all these things. So it's nice for the parents to see what the kids have been doing and what they will be working on. Yeah, so after our ceremony went inside and the kids were all inside on the computers. And they were just playing video. They're playing games like a kid was playing Need for Speed. I was like, oh, well, I hope they're just not here to play the games, but to actually learn English.
It gets them on the computer because that's an access point to so much.
Yeah, and just learning computer skills, learning how to type, learning how to, you know, click on files. And what my counterpart did was she made an agreement with the schools to incorporate computer lessons into their curriculum for the next school year.
That's terrific.
Really, yeah. And so it's free, and she just explained to them that they'll just pay like a small fee, which is like 500 RERI, which is like, what is that, like 6 cents maybe, a month. So every student pays that to have computer lessons as part of the curriculum for their next school year.
Well, it really makes you think when you have loose change sitting around in your car or at the bottom of your purse, what six cents will do.
Yeah, it's crazy. You could get really far with American money here.
What else is in the works as far as these computers? I mean, you know, what are the high schools doing with it and then the middle school?
They will keep it in their office so they can use it to, like, keep track of grades, print out stuff, write documents, because their computers were really outdated. They're super old. So now they just have, like, a good functioning computer that they can do a lot of good work on. What I was doing when I was fundraising, I would... see who gave us money, and then on my Instagram I would thank them. I would I took videos of my English club saying, like, for example, if my sister-in-law donated money, I would record them saying like, thank you Leha-ahel, and then I'll tag them on Instagram and thank them.
What made you decide to extend your stay there in Madagascar?
I mean, I really do like it here. I like speaking the language. I love the culture. People are so nice. The Peace Corps, other Peace Corps volunteers are super awesome. They're like my family, my community. They're like my family as well. And then there's one of the options to extend was with this organization called JSI. They're like a nonprofit organization that works with like community health. So it was a communications position.
And what does JSI stand for?
It's funny because it's, I don't know if you watch Game of Thrones, it's called for Jon Snow Incorporated. Jon Snow Inc. So JSI Research and Training Institute. And I'll actually get a home leave. When you extend, you get a home leave for 1 month. So I'll be back in Hawaii for Christmas. Want to go back for Thanksgiving, Christmas, and New Year's.
Well, that's terrific. It sounds like you're happy with your decision.
Well, the thing, I'm really happy because a lot of times we do things or they tell us they want this, they want this or that in our community. And they, for example, they get books, but it just sits there. Nobody really does anything with it. But luckily, my counterpart is so awesome. She has all these great ideas, and she's the most dedicated person I've ever seen. Just listening to her talk about what she wants to do with the community and how she wants to, like, improve the lives of the kids and give them, like, this opportunity is so awesome. So I know they will be put to good use, and I'm really excited for the kids to have this just chance at, like, a better education.
So what do you expect to accomplish then with this new position?
And I'm beginning to realize, like, there's so much more I can do, and there's a lot of, like, cool opportunities out there. So this is kind of like I feel like I'm just getting my foot into the door with this kind of work. And it's communication, like writing brochures, one-pagers, success stories, taking pictures, videos, storytelling. So
any advice that you might have to someone who might be on the fence about joining the Peace Corps?
It's such a unique experience that you just can't get, and you're like, they throw you out in the middle of nowhere, and you have to speak a language that you've learned for like 3 months, and just you have to figure things out, and just connections you make, lifelong friendships, life skills that you just acquire along the way. It's crazy. Like, I don't know where else you'd ever get to do that.
Now, Diaz has been sharing his Peace Corps experience through an online blog, which includes some great video clips and photos. We'll leave you with a snippet of a Malagasy moment from his online journal. From his Facebook page, Diaz writes this ditty about practicing numbers and vocabulary with his students. 1, 2, 3, Mahita means to see. 4, 5, Inina is 6. 7, 8, 9, Fotoana is time. 10, Avarino, repeat it again. He adds this about his students. When they're not driving me crazy, they can be cute and motivated sometimes. Cheers to the end of my last first semester of teaching here in Madagascar. Here's that sound clip. Hooray, that was a Malagasy moment thanks to Kamaka Diaz, Peace Corps worker from Hilo, who connected with us from far, far away in Madagascar. That's it for today. Up tomorrow, trying to get a handle on the abandoned and derelict vehicle problem across the state. Tell us what's on your mind. Do you have a problem with junk cars in your neighborhood? Call our talkback line and share what's going on in your community. The number to do that, 808-792-8217. You can also email us at talkback@hawaiipublicradio.org. We're on Facebook at The Conversation and Twitter at HI Conversation. I'm Catherine Cruz. Join us tomorrow, won't you, for more of The Conversation.